Welcome to Spark Your Fire podcast, sparking your interest in Australian property and finance. Now, here's your host, Jazz and David. But before that, let's listen to the quote of the week.
You guys will find that you have passions, and having a passion is a gift. I think we all have passions, and you don't get to choose them. They pick you, but you have to be alert to them. You have to be looking for them. And when you find your passion, it's a fantastic gift for you because it gives you direction, it gives you purpose. You can have a job, or you can have a career, or you can have a calling. And the best thing is to have a calling. And if you find your passion, you'll have that, and all your work won't feel like work to you.
G'day, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Spark Your Fire. I'm your host, David Shee. And as always, we've got our lovely co-host, Jazz, in Melbourne. Jazz, the weather's getting colder and colder at the moment. Is it freezing down there?
It surely is, man. But more than that, I'm just tired of being locked in at home with two kids. It's getting tiresome now.
It's hard to hear that from you, mate, given how much you love your kids and how much you spend your time with them. The other direction now.
There always comes a time where you're like, now I had enough of it. Like your wife had enough of it.
don't let your wife listen to this episode, mate. Just be careful. Careful what you say. It is recorded. So, I think it's an interesting phase. We are recording this around May period, and lockdown is starting to ease. And we're starting to see a to pick up in terms of activities again. And that's why today we thought we'll bring on someone who's quite authoritative in this area, especially in the property economy. There's lots of titles you can call him. But essentially, I think we have got Pete Wargent. For anyone who is working in the property or economist field, will know this name very well. He's made some really good posts. I've seen them across multiple media as well. So that's why I thought we'll bring Pete on today to share some of his insights on what's the current market looking like, and what are we up for in the coming few months, given the number of years of experience that you have here. So Pete, sorry about the long-winded introduction. Welcome to the show.
Pleasure. Thanks to be on. Yeah, it's great to be on. I've listened to your podcast over many months, and it's a long line of high-profile people. So, it's great to be on. I think, as you guys were saying, I've had the same thing here. I live at Noosa, but, we've been kind of locked away for a few weeks. And, there's everyone seems to be taking the opportunity to do their gardening, which is quite makes life pretty difficult when you're trying to do podcasts. But, really good to be on. Cheers.
So you're in Noosa at the moment, are you?
So our office is in Brisbane, but I actually live in Noosa. So it's a bit of a journey down, but I'm not in the office every day, so it works for me. But we a bit like yourself, had a couple of kids and thought we'd take the sea change. So we really enjoyed up here.
Beautiful place, I heard.
Thanks for coming on the show, Pete. Appreciate your time. Like David mentioned before in the intro, you've got wealth of experience in this space, and you run your own business, which is within the property space. But I really wanted to get started from a macro perspective of one. Pre-COVID, we saw the property market was booming again. It was starting to pick up, right? And came in the pin, which is the COVID-19. The banks have stepped in. They are suspending the mortgages. Government has stepped in. They are talking about, they are providing the JobKeeper and the JobSeeker payments. That's helping quite a lot, right? And that is going to continue for the next 6 months, because we know that's on the cards, right? But the bigger question is, where is the market headed once all this stimulus that has been provided by the banks in terms of suspending the payments and the government by providing the JobKeeper, JobSeeker, what's going to happen post that? Just to add a little bit more to that, personally, I don't understand. I mean, when I'm trying to think on my feet here of what's going to happen, I just don't see the environment to be the same like it was before, post all this. We're not going to see the international flights coming anytime soon from different countries, and tourism is one of the main sources of income for Australia, and so is the migration, which is international students. So all of that is going to disappear for a good period of time. I think it's safe to say for at least 12 months till the vaccine comes out. Some countries will open up like New Zealand and all. But if all of that gets halted, where are we headed? Sorry for the long-winded question, but...
Yeah, there's a few different points there. And as you rightly pointed out, one of the big things for Australia is that through the resources boom and then even beyond the resources boom, we were very much an economy driven by net overseas migration. And particularly in recent years, you know, the universities run the international student bandwagon, largely from China, India, and a number of other countries around Asia, but also tourism. So traditionally, the biggest source of short-term arrivals was New Zealand, but in recent years, China has been our number one source of visitors. So obviously, if you follow the chart of Chinese arrivals, it's just gone up and up and up over the months and years until suddenly it's just reached a sudden stop. So it's a bit like... Nassim Taleb's old graph of the life of a Thanksgiving turkey, you know, just got fatter and fatter, and then eventually we've just hit a dead wall. So I guess, some things will be different, and it's a very fluid situation at the moment. So as you said, the original plan was for a six-month hibernation, in inverted commas, of business and the economy, but by whether it's through luck or by judgment, Australia has flattened the curve much, much quicker than was expected. So we've got a $320 billion stimulus package in place, which was designed for a six-month shutdown, essentially. But we may well start to see restrictions easing much sooner than that. So I guess on that basis, you may well find that unemployment peaks at maybe around, say, 10% instead of what we were fearing at various points. And we may get back to business much sooner than we thought. But as you say, the economy on the other side will look a bit different, and it will have to be driven by resources exports, infrastructure projects, and home-based country production. We can't just go back to relying on international students and tourists, but at least for the next, as you said, probably year until international travel can come back on stream. I think it can from New Zealand, but probably not from the rest of the world.
What does the landscape look like for commercial property post COVID-19?
Yeah, I mean, I think just as a general point, I think the economy will get back to, it will be more normal than we think. I mean, take the example of, say, homeschooling. A lot of people are saying, yeah, after this, everyone will be homeschooling. But as you said, after a month, we're all sick of it. And I think it will be the same with things like, you know, rock concerts and going to the cinema. You know, people are itching to get back and just towards some kind of normality. The problem for commercial in the short term, obviously, is that you know, some businesses haven't had the footfall, particularly retail, and they've been trying to negotiate with landlords on rents, and they've, you know, there's been many instances of businesses not paying because they don't have a sustainable business. So in the short term, there's a lot of disruption. Generally speaking, I'm an optimist, so I think things will go back to, it will be more normal than we might think at the moment. But yeah, possibly there'll be, there's definitely a greater acceptance of things like Skype meetings and Zoom meetings. You know, I mean, Skype, as you know, 10 years ago was hard work, but now it's very easy. You just log on and off you go. And I think potentially, there'll be more things like people with serviced offices or shared office space, I think. But that was happening anyway. And I think it might just be there'll be a period of disruption, though, between now and the other side.
Mm-hmm. So how did you got started in this space, and what's your current situation with the portfolio?
Yeah, so, I was a chartered accountant by profession, and I actually started out as an investor in stock markets, and it was only when I met my now wife, who was a property investor before I was, that I really came across to the idea of using leverage in property to get ahead. So our journey has really been a shared one. So I think you know, she bought her first property, showing her age now, but back in the mid 1990s, and as you can hear, you know, I'm British born, so that was a property over in a place called Cambridge in England. So our initial journey was there, but then Subsequently, we built a portfolio in Sydney, and then we spread wider into other parts of Australia, so Brisbane, Melbourne. We still invest in the UK as well, mainly in London, but also in farmland. So it's been a long journey in property. We're very much on the real estate side of things. I always liked the idea of projects and flipping, but my wife just, she's from a farming background, and she's always been insistent that you just don't sell property. So I guess what we've done over a period of a couple of decades is amassed a large portfolio, and we've never sold a property over all that time. So I guess it's been very much a buy, add value and hold approach. And in recent years, we've been buying some farmland just to do something a bit different and try and diversify the portfolio.
So you have been mainly in the residential space or commercial as well?
Mainly residential, yeah. Right. It's only probably in the last few years that we've gone into buying agricultural land just to diversify. It's also inheritance tax-free in Britain, so it works pretty well from a tax point of view. But yeah, everything else has been residential. I think, you know, there is a place for commercial property investment, but to me, you see, when we started out, there wasn't all the information available that there is today. So I would say, you know, looking back, it wasn't much more sophisticated than, well, you know, we're two young professionals. You know, we like to live in Bondi near the train station because it's close to work. And, you know, if we like an area like this, then it's likely that other people will as well. And, yeah, I guess, you know, you make a few mistakes along the way, but I'd say probably 90% of it was just common sense. It's only sort of in recent years where there's this great wealth of information from, you know, people like yourselves sharing educational content that you've actually got, you know, some kind of a plan to follow. But yep. I guess our journey was, you know, quite many times we just bought properties, lived in them for a year or two, and then moved on to do it again and again. So, yeah, it wasn't any grand plan as such. We just kept on building.
So what's the portfolio worth?
I actually wouldn't even know because they're split across Australia and the UK. We've got a dozen properties in the portfolio. We've mostly tried to focus on the sort of, I guess, median price properties in Sydney and London. That's the bulk of the portfolio. So the most expensive in the portfolio, I guess, is probably 1.5, something like that. And we've that's down at Darling Harbour. We've got a couple of others, I guess one in Bondi that's worth around $1 million in the West. So I guess, yeah, I don't know the exact dollar value, but I think that the thing with us is that because we've been self-employed, I guess for about 10 years now, and you guys are brokers, so you know all about this, the borrowing capacity for us comes in fits and starts. And in fact, the LVR across our whole portfolio is now about 30% or maybe even 25% or something like that. So
that's awesome.
In recent years, we've kind of tapped out on borrowing capacity and we've had to, you know, look a bit more creatively in terms of how can we keep growing the property portfolio. So we've shifted more across to stocks as well in recent years. And also we've bought a couple of properties just for cash. Because if you're investing overseas these days, it's very difficult to secure financing at any kind of a reasonable mortgage rate. So, yeah, so look, we're not heavily geared on an LVR perspective. But I've always just taken the view that, you know, life changes as you go. So you just keep on finding ways to move forward. And, you know, if we're tapped out on borrowing capacity, we'll just look elsewhere at other alternatives.
Yeah, no, that's really good. What should the strategy for the investors who are starting or are halfway through, what should the strategy be?
Yeah, look, I guess there are different ways to do it. I've always taken the view that residential property in particular, if you don't get capital growth, it's not really a very good asset class. You'd be better off looking at the stock market if you want income. Look, there are different ways to do it. This is the way I've always approached things and, you know, coaching programs, we encourage people to do the same. And that's when you start with the property strategy, because everybody needs a property strategy, even if it's as a renter or a rent investor or, you know, portfolio investor, whatever it is. Work out what your borrowing capacity is today and what it's likely to be going forward. work out the optimal use of your borrowing capacity. And then once you've got your property portfolio set up, then you can go on to look at other things like the stock market for income, building your own businesses and so on. So that's the way I would approach it. Granted, there are different ways. But generally speaking, property for most people doesn't work that well as a flip. So I would try to get into the best areas that you can for long-term growth, get your property portfolio set up, and then when you're maxed out on your borrowing capacity, you can look at other ways to move forward.
The interest rates are at their lowest point now. It can't go any lower, right? So how do you see the capital growth coming out of the property market for the investors who are seeking capital growth in the future? Or it's not going to be sustainable anymore?
Yeah, well, look, I guess we have this conversation about every 5-10 years. There's always like, well, there are no more levers to pull, and then, you know, magically property markets continue their cycles. I think it's probably fair to say that interest rates since the early 90s have been a big driver of borrowing capacity. And I think obviously we've now hit the zero lower bound. As you know, you can probably borrow in Australia from the low twos now. In Britain, for the past 10 years, there have been mortgage rates even under 2%. So, yeah, realistically, mortgage rates can't really fall much further unless we go into the realms of negative interest rates, which I don't think will happen. So, yeah, I think it would be fair to say going forward, capital growth will probably be lower than what we've seen in the past because interest rates can't drive growth in the same way. And growth will probably be more closely tied to the growth in incomes. But in saying that, there are some property markets and parts and sectors of the market that just tend to be driven by desirability and scarcity. And that's usually, those kind of areas are driven more by people's growing wealth and the equity. So particularly in mature housing markets like Sydney or London, there are some areas where you could say, well, prices have kept up going ahead of incomes, but they're not really driven by income, they're just driven by wealth. So, yeah, I think overall, though, I think it's probably fair to say that a lot of those levers have been pulled. And, you should probably expect lower capital growth on average going forward.
You mentioned about stock market, right? So diversifying into stock market. How do you compare the two? And you have already mentioned a little bit about this, but how do you compare the two for the people who are trying to decide which one to go for to start with, new investors, right? How do you decide what is a better strategy, property or shares?
I think almost everybody seems to have a barrow to push on this sort of question. My view is a balance of both is a good place to end up. And the way I've always looked at it is that when you're younger, if you can make a start with a leveraged investment, I mean, obviously that can help to get you off to a head start because of you're magnifying the results. Now, of course, you have to be careful when you use leverage and it's a long-term investment, but when you look at it, I mean, there are not that many stock market investors who are able to manage portfolios of a few million dollars. They really are quite few and far between. Whereas in property, I think because people psychologically feel much more comfortable with the idea of bricks and mortar, a lot of people can manage portfolios that, you know, 7-8 figures. So my view has always been, you know, build a property strategy first, and then let that do what it does, and then move on to stocks because they're complementary but very different asset classes. Stock markets tend to be very good at generating passive income. Property, particularly resi property, doesn't really ever get you there from an income perspective. There are always holding costs and vacancies, and it's not very tax effective from an income perspective. So that's my view. Start with the property, get some assets under your belt, and then once you've got that part of your portfolio up and running, take a look at stocks. But there are different ways to do it, of course.
Why did you choose to diversify into farmlands? Like, why not other asset classes or other asset types in residential rather than farmlands? Well, I'm just curious in terms of the thinking behind that.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. It's partly because of my wife's background. So we inherited some farmland anyway. Which is kind of what got me interested in it. I was quite interested in the idea of HMO property, which in Britain is houses of multiple occupancy. And you can, if you're prepared to put the hard work in, I mean, you can generate 15% yields, you know, gross yields from that type of property. So the most popular strategy is you buy a terraced house with, say, 4 or 5 bedrooms in a university city, and then you rent out the property by the room. Yep. So you might have, say, 5 tenants. But the thing is with that, it's a very labor-intensive approach. So, and in the end, I decided I didn't really want more headaches in my life. But if you're prepared to put in the hard work, and it might be 15% gross yield and maybe 8 or 9% net, but there are ways that you can generate income from residential property such as that. But we actually had some farmland, and I guess in Britain it's inheritance tax free, which was a consideration for us. But it's mainly just that it's very passive, so you don't have to farm land yourself. Obviously, you can just subcontract it out. Plus, there are this is not advice, by the way, but there are some area payments that you can get to actually increase the yield in Britain. So it's not a high yield investment, but I guess, as the old adage goes, they're not making any more of it. And my view was that with Brexit and now with the coronavirus, that the land, cropland in particular, will be, you know, high yielding, and it will be highly sought after. So, but it's a land banking strategy,
isn't it? Yeah.
Okay. But it's not for everyone. But we had some land anyway, and strategically we could add to. We could add to it nearby, so we've just done a bit of that. But and if you can buy land that's close to the edge of a town, of course, there's always the potential for rezoning or constructing on it later down the track.
So preparing for the next few generations to come. And do you expect to see subdivisions to happen at your generation, or it's going to be your son, your daughters, the next generation?
Yeah, look, hopefully. Yeah, I mean, in fact, some of the land we've got was earmarked for housing about 25 years ago, but for whatever reason, it's never happened. So, but it's a very convoluted process, as you know, with planning. And I think that quite often it's brown paper bags decides who gets funny and who doesn't.
And how many brown paper bags
is going
to go through. Okay. The other question I have is with the current, I guess, we're seeing a bit of positivity now. Now, do you expect that the property market is going to be a V-shaped recovery, or how do you see this?
You know what, the more I look at it, the more I actually think potentially yes. Just following the data, so Australia was, you know, we flattened the curve in incredibly quick time. So as you mentioned, I think earlier on, you know, we're going back towards open homes and auctions. But when you actually look at the stock on the market now, SQM put out their latest figures today. I mean, Sydney's stock is down about 20% from a year ago. There's very little on the market. So if people feel suddenly that there's light at the end of the tunnel and buyers start coming back, then potentially we could see a V-shaped recovery. I think now you guys would have a better handle on this than me, but potentially mortgage processing times might be a bit of a bottleneck. And, you know, potentially, obviously some people have their borrowing capacity impacted, but you know, as we saw after the election last year, when you get a drop in the amount of stock on the market and then buyers come back in, I mean, that can really, really push prices up, at least in the short term. I suppose the bigger fundamental question is how does the Australian economy operate with no immigration, you know, and how long does that go on for? You know, if it's 6 months, there's no big deal. But if it drags on to be a few years, then that's a whole different question. So, yeah, it's a very fluid environment at the moment. But, you know, the historically low interest rates have always stimulated demand for property, because where else are people going to put their money? Cash in the bank is worth nothing these days. Stock markets offering a bit more value now, but a lot of people just don't trust markets. And so real estate is always one of the popular vehicles for investing. So if we're starting to open up again from next week, then I think potentially we could see a bounce.
How do you see the stock market? Do you think it will jump back to its all-time high? Or
I think it's there's a bit of a tug of war going on. Obviously, the Federal Reserve in the US is tipping an unprecedented amount of stimulus in a very short space of time. So obviously QE we saw in the GFC, but it took some time for that really to flow through, whereas this time around the Fed's just gone all in straight away, and that's what's essentially caused the bounce in stocks. I think if you just look at it from a macro point of view, business earnings are going to take a massive knock over the next 6, 9, 12 months. And when you actually account for that, markets are still very expensive, particularly in the US. Australia, not quite so much. But I guess the thing to watch these days, with the US being half of the global market cap, and we see this all the time, if the US goes down, everywhere else follows. And if the US goes up, we all follow. So I guess that's the thing to watch, is that if the US market takes another leg down, we'll almost certainly follow. And if you look at the more reliable measures of valuation, like the CAPE ratio at 27 in the US, it's still pretty high, given that we know we're going into a recession. So it's never been sustained at that kind of level before. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if it takes another leg lower. If we, say, for the sake of argument, go back to the US economy running at, say, 80% of its previous capacity, I mean, if you think about that, you know, for a lot of businesses, that final 20%, that is their profit margin. So, yeah, there's a lot of different sectors, but earnings could be impacted for a long time. And at the moment, markets are looking across to a distant future point. So I think you're right. I think at some point the market becomes a weighing machine again, and they will fall.
Post COVID-19, how do you see this rental market?
Rental markets, I think, will be more impacted than prices. I think that's my view. I think if you look at recessions and what's happening, for example, in Britain, transactions are always the first things to get hit in a recession, and that's definitely what's happened. Settled sales were down almost by half in April. Prices were basically, you know, not really that much changed. There was some price discounting at the higher level, you know, the 2 million price bracket, especially in places like Melbourne and so on. But I think the more initial impact is going to be seen in the rental market, as you say. International students haven't come back in many cases. Some temporary visa holders have had to depart. We don't have the flow of short-term arrivals for tourism or permanent migrants. And a lot of Airbnb owners are finding, well, they can't let on Airbnb, so they're having to come across to the rental market. So a lot of areas have already seen a 5 or 10% increase in rental listings. And as just for generally, there's a lot of people who have been stood down, and therefore the rental market is pretty weak just fundamentally at the moment. So I think the bigger impact will be seen on rents rather than prices. It probably is location dependent to a certain extent. We saw today AIG put out its construction figures. I mean, they're at the lowest levels in the history of the data series. So I think the new dwelling supply is going to drop to the lowest level in probably 70 years or something. So eventually things will find an equilibrium. And yeah, as you said, Australia does have a very strong demographic pyramid. So the population pyramid, we've got record numbers of people coming into that sort of 28 to 35 age bracket where they'll be renting, forming households. So eventually things will find an equilibrium, but I suspect over the next 6 or 12 months, landlords might have to come to the party a little bit and reduce rents. That's my guess.
I should get ready for that, I guess.
Yeah, and the way I tend to look at it is on a portfolio view. So most of my tenants have just kept on paying the same as always, and there's no issue, but I wouldn't be at all surprised that if you look at it across the portfolio, probably you might see a rental reduction here or there, or maybe somebody will lose a job and be unable to pay for a few months. I mean, I guess if you look at it across the portfolio, you just look at it that way, and that's part and parcel of being a landlord.
The type of properties to look out for capital growth in the residential space, will that fundamentally change over the next few years post this whole situation, or the fundamentals still are intact?
Yeah, I think certainly areas that were reliant on tourism are going to be quite heavily hit, so I'd probably avoid those coastal regions, for example. So I think most of the fundamentals are the same. The biggest buying demographic is still families. The scarcity, you know, generally speaking, you look for high land to asset ratio, good school zones, transport links to the city, proximity to amenities, to employment hubs and so on. So I don't think those fundamentals have changed too much. The scarce commodity really in Australian property is well-located land. So if you can find, you know, first and foremost, go for location. Usually I think the best use of borrowing capacity is if you can find somewhere that's good enough to rent out today, ideally at least a three-bedder, but it's got some future value-add potential as well, then that's a win-win. So I would try to look for a property with a high land-to-asset ratio, and I'd say mostly just use common sense and look for, you know, points of scarcity and, you know, some future value-add potential or sort of equity on ice, as they call it.
So I saw a news and I shared the article with David a couple of days ago. Me Bank recently put a limit on the redraw facility of how much money you can redraw. And also they closed some of the redraw accounts or took the money off the redraw accounts to cover up the mortgages, basically, right? Which sort of tells you to some extent that they are worried about the loan-to-value ratios. Do we see that becoming a bit of an issue with the other banks as well? Or what are your thoughts in general?
Yeah, so it was interesting to see. So Westpac put out its half year, so its H1 figures yesterday. So there's a few different things going on. 90-day arrears are still pretty much tracking in line with what they were. But it's interesting to see 30-day arrears, and this only goes to 31 March, 30-day arrears are starting to just tick up. So I think they're at about 188 basis points. They were at about 150 or so a year ago. So we're just starting to see the first signs of stress there on mortgage repayments. And also, I suppose, running alongside that, a lot of people have opted to take mortgage payment holidays. And I think we'll only see the true extent of that as the figures roll through over the next 3 or 6 months. So, so banks are obviously concerned about provisions and losses. You know, the loss rate on loans for the big four banks, very, very low. It's like 5 basis points or something. So, you know, over the past decade, they've seen very, very low levels of loss on, you know, for the major banks. But this is a recession, and that's traditionally where you do see the losses coming through. So, yeah, it will definitely be one to watch. The banks always put out these apparently very reassuring slides showing that, you know, most borrowers have enormous buffers, and, you know, most borrowers are miles ahead on repayments, and LVRs are low across the portfolio. But the thing is, the averages, they mask a lot of underlying stress, and that is, it's not the average borrower that gets into trouble, it's the marginal borrower who's, you know, 95% LVR, they probably bought recently, they've got less buffer, you know, that's where the stress tends to show up. So the sooner we can get back to business, the better, really.
It's kind of a margin call, essentially, what you're doing.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, you would have to check the terms of your own redraw account to see whether the bank can actually do that. One of the things with residential property is that you don't generally see loans getting called in. You know, it would be highly impractical for banks to say, well, we're revaluing the entire resi portfolio and anyone with an LVR above 100% has to repay, you know, effectively like a margin call, as you said. It can happen with commercial loans, but for residential property, that's close to unheard of. So, I don't know the details of the ME bank issue, but, I guess this is where you need to understand the terms of your own redraw account and whether there are potential caps on it.
The way they look at it essentially is for redraw accounts, it's because it's part of the loan account. So therefore, the banks does have the ability, and under their terms and conditions, they may have put in a clause to say, in a worst case condition, we can actually put that money in terms of paying down the loan, because it's the same type of loan account, if not the same account, you know what I'm saying? Whereas if it's an offset account, it's a separate entity as such. So therefore, under the terms and conditions again, you know, the banks may not necessarily have the authority to be able to merge those two accounts together as much as they like to. So, you know, I think from a, and this is touching into sort of more loan structuring type of things. But again, as what Pete suggests, every banks have different terms and conditions. It's better off to double check on that just to make sure that, you know, you're not being caught out on this because it is an interesting thing that we're starting to see. And I think MiBanking in particular, because they are, I mean, they're funded by super funds at the end of the day, and they're being impacted by that 10K early withdrawal that that government's allowing. So I think they may start to see a little bit of concern about liquidity issues, even though they're not they don't come out and say it, of course. That's just my thinking behind it.
Yeah, no, I think you hit the nail on the head, David, over there, because they're funded by the superannuation funds, and there's a lot of withdrawals that have been happening. And that's, I think, caused a bit of an issue for them to sustain their model. Basically,
Pete, there's been talks about replacing stamp duty with annual land tax. What are your thoughts on this, and how do you think it's going to impact property market moving forward if it gets implemented?
Yeah, so it really comes down to the rate. What rate is land tax going to be levied if that is the case? Because I would say for most first home buyers, the hurdle to getting in these days is not the mortgage repayment, which serviceability is as good as we've seen really in the past 20 or 30 years. The hurdle for most people is saving the deposit and the stamp duty and closing costs. So from in a short-term perspective, that could be quite bullish because it opens up the potential for many more first home buyers or other buyers to come into the market. So one of the things that stamp duty does, it actually discourages people from flipping because the transaction costs are so high. It depends really how high the land tax is. Obviously, if there was a high rate of land tax levied, that would be negative for the housing market. But politically, I think that would be all hell to pay if you went in with a high rate of land tax. Because if you look at some of the US states like Texas, where they've got a very high rate of land tax, I mean, you effectively never own the property. You're continually having to shell out annual payments. So I don't think we'd end up with a high rate of land tax because at the end of the day, if they did that, it would actually be decreasing the value of the land that they could levy the tax on. And I don't think that's what I don't think that would get across the line politically. So I think it all depends on the small print, really. If they remove stamp duty, obviously more buyers can come in. But if the rate's too high, then people will, you know, they'll
scratch people. Yeah,
turn their attention elsewhere. Yeah, for sure. Mm.
Okay, awesome.
Three tips for investors who are starting their journey that will help them build their portfolio.
I'm just thinking back to when I started. I think, firstly, you need to educate yourself because the thing is with property, it is not like in the stock market where you make lots of decisions. You know, potentially in property, you only make a handful of decisions over a course of 10 or 20 years. But the ones that you do make are much bigger. So I would say, firstly, start with education. Secondly, I would always, if it was me starting out today, I would always look for the best location I could afford because I guess, certain areas have got a proven performance of high capital growth, and those areas tend to remain desirable over the long term as the population grows and they become more sought after and scarce. So secondly, go for location. And I think, thirdly, I guess the only thing with investing and building portfolios is that stuff will change. And I don't just mean the economy, the environment, but your goals will change. You know, your stage of life will change. And, you know, one of the things we talk about in our coaching programs is that there are 9 different personality types. So it's no good, you know, me saying to you, you need to do things this way, and this way. Because it's different for everybody. We all have different underlying motivations. But I guess the third thing is just keep finding ways to move forward, because the landscape will change, your goals will change over time. But as long as you keep building, then the compounding effects will keep working for you. And if you reach, if you max out your borrowing capacity, then, you know, look somewhere else. Just keep finding ways to move forward, whether that's in property or building your own business or in the stock markets. There are always places you can keep on moving forward.
Switching gears a little bit, bank bail-ins and bailouts on the cards and the probability.
Can we finish the interview there? I guess this is where it goes back to reading the small print. Look, if you're somebody who's got a very high level of cash, then I would say it makes sense to, one of the first rules of investing, diversification, don't have all of your eggs in one basket. So I think if you've got a high level of cash, it would make sense to spread it around across a few different institutions. I think the likelihood is very low. However, you know, if you think of the old risk matrix that they used to show you in business school, you know, the likelihood might be low, but the impact is high. So, look, if you're worried about it and you've got a high level of cash that might be above what is guaranteed, then I would say probably makes sense just to spread your risk around a bit. But yeah, generally speaking, I don't think the risk is particularly high. It's more just a risk management tool.
Aliens, believe it or not.
Aliens? Yeah, I do. I do think there's life out there. So, sometimes you see some of the stuff going on in Australian politics, you think it's probably closer to home than we think it is. But, I do believe in aliens.
Do you think they are smarter than us and equally obsessed about the property?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think if you actually, I often go out at night here. We had a meteor shower this week. I often get out there and stare up into space, because you've got very clear skies here at Noosa. We're just on the coast, and when you look at the sheer scale of the universe, I think it's logical to think there must be other forms of life, and therefore more advanced forms. But I guess whichever planet or landscape people would be on, the land itself must always be valuable, so therefore probably yes.
What is the likelihood of that we are in a simulation?
A simulation. I don't think we're in a simulation. That's a tough question, but I don't believe in the afterlife. I think we get one shot. So, I don't think it's the Matrix, though.
AI, do you think it will take over humanity?
These are really interesting questions, because I think we're finding with AI that it can do an awful lot of stuff, even creative stuff. You know, if you've got enough data and enough technology, then AI can be remarkably efficient. Now, I think it probably could happen. Whether or not we should allow the advances in technology is a different moral question. So, it's something that it worries me personally. I'm glad I'm not my kids' age, because the rate of change and technology could be very high for them. Mm. And you already see some of the stuff that's available, and driverless cars and laser printing and things like that. They can be used for good, but they can also be used for negative means as well. So that's really what worries me.
Inflation, deflation, stagflation?
I think in the short term, we actually will see some deflation, partly just simply to do with the demand shock, but also if you look at the price of oil, I mean, it's gone from $70 to, well, on the futures contract, it went below zero this month. And I guess at the time of speaking, $20 a barrel, I mean, that's got to be deflationary. I think if you look at the next quarter for Australia, if you account for childcare costs and the price of petrol or fuel, we'll probably see negative inflation. I don't think it'll persist, though. I think the amount of stimulus being applied from the government, the Reserve Bank, central banks around the world, it will probably lift inflation again. But I think in the short term, we might actually see some negative inflation.
Do you think inflation is actually required or is a good thing?
Well, I think inflation, like too much of anything, is a bad thing. Inflation, if you look at the alternative, so countries like Japan that have gone for, you know, long periods of deflation, that's not a good thing. But you don't want too much inflation because it can make it very difficult for businesses or investors to make decisions when there's so much uncertainty. So I think the best thing is stable inflation. To me, I would say Australia's got the right idea with a high inflation target of 2 to 3%. The only problem is central bank keeps missing the target. So, I think if we can keep it in the 2 to 3% range, that's a sensible way to go. I do think there's an argument to say we should look at targeting nominal GDP instead of inflation, just because I think, you know, in recent years, we've been miles away from full employment for far too long and for no good reason, to my mind. So, there's arguments for making some tweaks there. Yeah, I think it's a bit of a misnomer when people talk about the, you know, the CPI, because when you look at the component parts, the inflation is largely in things like education, healthcare costs, property costs, land values, which isn't captured in the CPI. But if you actually think about things like, I bought a new laptop this week. I mean, what you get for your money is just worlds apart from what we used to get. Same with televisions. A lot of clothing is as cheap as it's been in decades. There'll be a lot of deflation, but in certain components of the index. But the inflation tends to get loaded into things like healthcare and education and particularly land values in Australia.
Yep. Last one. Crypto, here to stay or a fad?
Good Lord. I don't have a strong view on crypto. I think the Reserve Bank's official line is that the incentives would be too great for people to misuse cryptocurrencies and therefore we should stick with what we've got. But then they would say that. I don't have a strong understanding of it. So I've steered clear. But I've been proven wrong because the price has stayed higher for longer than I thought it might.
You're in the same boat like everyone else, except me probably. Everyone we had on the show, we have asked the question lately, and they all like it's a fad or blockchain is here to stay and everything, all the currencies will just disappear. But I've got a little bit different opinion.
Before we wrap up, I just thought, I thought this is a good opportunity because, Pete, I think you just released your new book a couple of days ago. Is that right?
So it's not in Dimex yet, but I can...
Minute summary of what it's about, just so our listeners.
My new book, which I've co-authored with Stephen Moriarty, is called Low Rates, High Returns, and it's been a little bit delayed because of the coronavirus and the bookstores being closed, but it'll be in the bookstores in the next couple of weeks. You can already pre-order it at Dimex. So the book is Low Rates, High Returns, and actually, if you want a free chapter, you can just go to this website. It's www.lowrateshighreturns.com/book. And you can get a whole chapter there. Just download it for free.
And what is it about in terms of, is it stock market? Is it property?
It's mainly stock market.
Stock market.
Yeah, how to tackle the challenge of low interest rates, because we wrote this book at the back end of last year, and just as we thought, interest rates have gone to effectively zero, and not just in Australia, it's all around the world now. So it's really tackling, if money in the bank and term deposits and bonds aren't paying what they used to, how do you address managing your own money? So the principles are timeless, though, and they can be applied to any asset class, whether it's property, stock markets, vintage cars, probably crypto for all I know.
Yeah, that's a nice one. Okay. Well, look, I think it's, you know, for the purpose that, you know, this is an educational podcast anyway, so I thought it's worth mentioning that for those listeners who are interested in knowing that. And all disclosure, Jazz and I do not get anything, any incentive out of that. It's just for the pure benefit of our listeners, okay?
For our listeners, hope you guys are enjoying the content. And if you are, please don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on iTunes or whatever app you're using, and let the word spread like a fire, spark your fire.
If you have any questions or feedback about today's episode, you can reach out to us through sparkyourfirepodcast@gmail.com. That's sparkyourfirepodcast, all one word, @gmail.com. Also, the content discussed in this episode is general in nature. Please seek specific advice from qualified professionals in regards to your personal situation.